Hello everyone, it's Tim here. As you know, we have only the very best guests on Vox Talks Economics. But when I recorded our excellent Nobel Economics preview podcast with Paul Novosad and Sam Asher, which we published last week, little did I know that the very next interview I would record would be with one of the winners of the 2024 Nobel Prize for Economics. On Monday, Simon Johnson and Daron Acemoglu shared the prize with James Robinson. And James was my guest on this recording, which we're bringing to you as an extra episode. Today on Vox Talks Economics, why do snitches get stitches? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week, we bring you the best new research in economics. Remember, subscribe. Follow us on Instagram as well at Vox Talks Economics. The saying, don't be a toad in Colombia, tells people to mind their own business. Don't tell on others. Well, that's hardly unique to Colombia. A Brazilian person might tell you that cagueta mori cedo, which means rats die early. And a few thousand kilometres north, in American playgrounds, bullies are warning their victims that snitches get stitches. Well, it's easy to imagine why groups adopt pro-social norms, like sharing or volunteering, but what sustains an anti-social norm like this one? James Robinson of the University of Chicago is one of the authors of a new discussion paper that investigates this particular antisocial norm, and he joins me now. James, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thank you very much.
James, first of all, let's talk about norms. What are norms? What do we mean when we talk about norms? Where do they come from?
You know, I think by a social norm, we mean a kind of informal, unwritten rule that guides normal or acceptable behavior in a community or a society. Where they come from, that's a topic of great interest. It's very under-researched. I mean, that's something we've been trying to understand in this Colombian case. One view would be that norms evolve to solve problems in society. And, you know, you could think that written rules or laws or constitutions were sometimes just formalizing norms in a community. But in that one specific case that we look at in Colombia, I think the origins of that seem to be in Iberian culture, in Spanish culture.
Right.
But it's been amplified by the Colombian context, in particular, the history of conflict and violence in Colombia.
All societies have these norms. They also have more formal institutions, the rules of the game, rule of law. What do social norms contribute to the lives of people in a society distinct from those more formal rules?
Yeah. Well, I think that's an unresearched question. It's one of the motivations for doing this research is that, you know, I've worked a lot over the years on the role of institutions in economic development and the origins of different types of institutions, democracy.
Yeah.
But we tend to focus on what you might call formal institutions, written things, constitutions, and things you can measure much more easily than informal institutions. But I think if you work in the developing world, you realize that this enormous amount of informal order is massively consequential for the equilibrium and how people behave there. But it's very understudied. What you have is a large experimental literature, mostly focused on developed countries about pro-sociality and cooperation. And when you hang out in Colombia, you know, as I have been doing for 32 years, you see enormous amounts of dysfunctional social norms and social practices everywhere. You're right, of course, that don't be a toad, which means mind your own business. If you see somebody behaving antisocially or whatever, it's none of your business. Like, stay out of it. That norm, there's versions of it everywhere. In my personal experience, I've never been in a place where it's invoked so frequently in kind of ordinary, you know, like in England. You know, in England, you could say there's versions of that. But if you actually invoked it, it would be thought really weird.
Yeah.
But in Colombia, it happens that people do it all the time. So I think there's a sort of quantitative difference in how these things are used. And so I think that's why we wanted to study that. And it's such a striking difference from many of this sort of pro-social types of norms that have been studied in Switzerland or the United States. United States or something. Mm. You know, there is a literature on this, but I think what's kind of innovative about the piece is trying to study a really existing social norm in the world. And as you're alluding to, trying to understand historically, where did this come from? There's very little work on things like that.
Let me ask you one more thing about norms, the pro-social norms. If you study political economy these days, then you study the work of yourself and your colleagues that shows that more formal institutions, they are linked to economic development. Do we know something like that about pro-social norms? Does it have an economic benefit?
I think there's correlations, but I wouldn't say that there's really good evidence that pro-social norms have a big independent effect on economic development. I don't think there's one killer piece of evidence on that, to be honest with you. I think the classic case would be Italy, the north and south of Italy. You know, Robert Putnam's work on social capital. His social capital is a big rubric that includes all sorts of things, including types of pro-social behavior and generalized trust and things like that. But, you know, even on that Italian case, which has been studied so definitively, I don't think anyone would be able to agree on what was the independent role of this kind of informal order on the relative economic success of the north of Italy, for example.
Recently, Vox Talks interviewed James's co-Nobelist, Daron Acemoglu, about his book, Power and Progress. The episode was published in June 2023. And our sister podcast, Vox Dev Talks, also interviewed James Robinson in September 23. Follow Vox Dev Talks wherever you get your podcasts to listen to the episode Political Economy and Development.
Let's have a look at what you've done in this paper, which is fascinating. But first of all, I want to ask you a theoretical question. If there was a norm that was universally adhered to, which is don't be a toad, never snitch, don't grass anyone up, what ends up being the impact on the lives of the people in that group?
We look at this in the end of the day, you know, in an experimental context with students in Bogota, at a university in Bogota. You're asking a much bigger question about what's the impact of that on people's lives in Colombia. One reason to expect these informal norms to be much more important in a place like Colombia is that the formal order is like very weak and unimplemented. Mm. You know, the Colombian state doesn't control half of the country. Half of the country is controlled by paramilitary groups and drug gangs and rebels and guerrillas and Marxist revolutionary groups are still out there. Mm-hmm. So there's no real mechanism enforcing the laws or the constitution in Colombia. That, you could say, is a context in which you'd expect this sort of informality to thrive and be much more important. But again, you know, like your question about what evidence do we have that these norms are really critical for development? I mean, the experiments we ran show very nicely that once you allow the Colombian students to invoke these social norms, the pro-social equilibrium unravels. But mm-hmm. what does that mean in reality? You know, I mean, I could give you lots of examples from my personal experience. One interesting example is the former mayor of Bogota, Antanas Mocus. Mm-hmm. You know, he thought this was so important, he mounted a campaign. He used to have a fabric toad sewed onto his lapel to remind people that it was good to be a sapo. You know, it was good to correct antisocial behavior. So he certainly thought it was first order in Colombia, but I don't really have any estimates on that, unfortunately, just a kind of gut feeling. The other thing which is tricky, of course, is that there's many different antisocial norms in Colombia, not just no ser sapo. Mm-hmm. There's lots of other ones. Like the Colombian 11th commandment is don't give papaya. They call it the 11th commandment. Don't give papaya. So if I give you papaya, it's like I'm giving you an opportunity to take advantage of me. So, the 12th commandment is if someone gives you papaya, take it, you know. So, that just to say, of course, it's extremely difficult to disentangle the effect of one of these norms relative to all the other ones because there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
So that makes that very tricky to make a statement about the world, the impact on the equilibrium more broadly.
Okay, well, then let's focus right down on the research then. You based this on the dictator game. For those people who are unfamiliar with the dictator game, what are the usual rules of it? What's it designed to test?
The original design was to show that people don't behave in the way that economic theory predicts. I have $10 or whatever it is, or £10, and I have to divide it between me and you. And so if you were a rational economic agent, what would you do? Well, you just keep all the money yourself. Like, why would I give you anything? You know, everything I give you, £1 I give to you is £1 less for me. Mm-hmm. That's actually not how people play it. In reality, people do share the money. So I have the money, I can divide it between me and you, and that's it. And we take the money and we go home. So there's no sanction for being selfish or whatever. Maybe they give a third, or they give a quarter, or some people even give a half. They split it 50-50. That game, it sounds so trivial and simple, but it exploded like a bombshell in the economics profession. I don't know when that was first run, in the 1980s, probably. That's a very simple context where you can look at how selfish, or, you know, how generous are you? And there's a very clear notion of, like, what's fair. You know, if you tend to ask people what's the fair division there, they say 50-50. And there's a version of that game which is slightly elaborated, where you have a third party. So you add a third party, and the third party can punish the dictator. So the dictator is the person who divides the money in the first place. The third party observes and can punish the dictator for not being fair. There's a very famous paper on this by Fair and Fischbacher, that what you see is that third parties are actually willing to punish unfair behavior. And understanding that that can happen, it makes the dictators more generous. We thought this was the perfect environment.
I can see where we're going with this.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. We thought this was the perfect environment because this don't be a toad, it seems to be almost designed to kind of kill this third party force towards greater fairness. The third party is like the sapo. It's like somebody intervening where somebody is behaving unfairly. And then we just allow the dictator, if they're punished by the third party, to call that person the sapo. We use the kind of softer language than that because we thought maybe that's too strong. And we just use the Spanish version of, like, mind your own business. And we thought maybe there's just more kind of external validity. The sapo thing seems to be very Colombian, the toad thing. Mm-hmm. There are analogous expressions, but the sapo seems to be very Colombian. So what we show is that once you allow this sapo aspect of the game, then that completely unravels the effect of third party enforcement. So that's the main result in the paper.
But the people who are taking part in this, what do they think of the norm? Do they think it's okay to be a sapo?
Yeah, so that's one of the most interesting parts of the paper too, which is we use this method where you can try to elicit people's normative beliefs. I think we just didn't know what the answer was going to be to that. First of all, they think it's appropriate to be fair.
Yeah.
They think it's appropriate to punish unfairness, but they think it's inappropriate to call people a sapo. So they think it's inappropriate to invoke this norm. Nevertheless, the majority of people believe that if punished, the person who is punished will call the other person a sapo. So I think the way we tried to characterize that, we have this sort of simple model in the paper also. I don't know how deep it is, but that was like ourselves trying to kind of understand how this equilibrium fits together. You know, how can it be that you're trapped in a situation which you yourself think is kind of normatively inappropriate, but nevertheless, that's what's going to happen. And there's some very interesting policy consequences of that, in the sense that the Colombians sort of understand that this is an undesirable situation, and somehow they can't get out of it. But that's a very different situation than actually the Colombians think it's fine to call people a sapo. You know, that's somehow a much more intractable problem. So the normative evidence that we have in the paper, I think it tells you a lot about maybe this equilibrium is easier to get out of than we thought it was, than you might have thought it was.
So there's a sort of a cognitive dissonance going on here, is people think it's a bad idea that, you know, we have this don't be a sapo norm. They think that you shouldn't hold to it, but everyone holds to it.
I suspect that's common in a lot of contexts. Oh, yeah, you know, you might think, yes, it would be great to have public goods and everybody should contribute to the public welfare, but there's always an incentive to sort of free ride, and I think other people will free ride. I think you could say that's a kind of specific evidence on a class of problems in society. It has something in common with other sorts of problems. As I said, you know, in the dictator game, if you ask people typically what's the fair split, some people might split 50-50, but the majority of people don't. Because there's a trade-off, if you like, between, you know, if you thought of your preferences involving, like, you have some elements of social preferences, you kind of care about the allocation of resources more generally, but you have a private interest in not being fair. When you play the dictator game, you trade off your private preferences with your social preferences. I mean, that's one way of thinking about it.
Can you be sure that this experiment maps to day-to-day life? I suppose your evidence is 32 years of experience in Colombia, but how else can you be sure that this is an accurate reflection of Colombian society?
So I think one thing about the paper, again, which again we found pretty surprising and striking, was after we'd done the basic experiments, we started reading a lot about the history of this sapo. Mm-hmm. And we discovered that there's a lot of discussion of it back in the 1950s at the time of the civil war called La Violencia.
Right,
so sapo became like a language of the war. And you could see why. It was a civil war that started basically between the liberal and conservative parties in 1948. But then it kind of morphed into a much broader conflict between different militias and paramilitary groups. You're in a civil war where a lot of different groups are fighting each other. You're trying to control information. You're trying to stop people informing the other people where you are or where your troops are and who's on which side. You can sort of imagine that stopping people being sapos mm-hmm. in that conflict, the stakes get very high. When we read that, we thought like, oh gosh, you know, like this always happens with research. After you've done it, you think of something you should have done. So then what we did was we had all the telephone numbers of the students who took the experiments. Mm-hmm. So then we administered this other survey asking about your family's history of victimization, your grandparents, were they displaced during La Violencia? Were they liberals? Because a lot of the people who were victimized were liberals because it was a conservative government, very militarized conservative government. So we asked questions about the family history of La Violencia. And what we show is that that correlated with people's behavior. I don't want to make a big causal statement here, you know, but that is robustly correlated with the way people play these games. So that I found really striking, that this sort of family history of La Violencia somehow gets intergenerationally transmitted to these students today and affects the way they play these games. So I think that could be evidence of what you're talking about, which is this is very first order in Colombian society. Like the fact that you can trigger different ways of playing this game or different sensitivity to adding this sapo move into the game as a function of the history of the victimization of your family in the 1950s. I mean, we found that very striking.
I mean, on the one hand, it makes perfect sense. But on the other hand, the idea that this gets passed down through generations is quite remarkable when you think about it.
It is remarkable. There's a lot of very interesting work in economics at the moment on this socialization and this intergenerational transmission of social norms. But yeah, it's pretty surprising. I mean, I think if you talk to Colombians, it's interesting the extent to which things like that are preserved, you know, in the sense mm-hmm. of the history of the family, of displacement, of violence, of kidnapping. You know, for decades, Colombia was the kidnapping capital of the world. Everybody I know has some relative who's been kidnapped or harassed or shaped. But how it translates into how you play these games, I guess there's a psychology to that I'm not an expert on, how those things trigger the way you react to this kind of experimental environment. And I'm not sure I understand the micro foundations for that.
Does this lead us then to some formal definition of what an antisocial norm is? How do we capture that?
You know, we try to advance the definition of an antisocial norm, which is it basically has this property that it's simultaneously thought to be normatively undesirable, mm-hmm. but it's also invoked by a majority of people in equilibrium. So despite the fact that the majority of people think it's undesirable, nevertheless, in equilibrium, a majority of people invoke this norm. That seems to be a reasonable way of thinking about it. And I guess we're just trying to make an argument that there's maybe something conceptually of broader interest here. Going back to talking about my work on institutions, if you're interested in the relationship between institutions and development, it seems that the problem with informal institutions or social norms in developing countries has got to be something to do with them being antisocial.
Yeah.
The fact that people understand this, I think, is a rather hopeful conclusion. A lot of these things, when they're discussed, for example, you know, think of female genital mutilation. People think the intractable aspect of it is that the people in the societies that are practicing it believe it to be normatively appropriate, believe that female genital mutilation should happen.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true, actually, to be honest with you. I'm not sure there's any real evidence on that of the sort we mm-hmm. collected. It would be an interesting thing to look at. If that were true, that would be a very different situation from the one that we uncover in Colombia.
James, one of the few hopeful strands of literature in conflict economics is the post-conflict, after people have been exposed to violence, that can strengthen pro-social norms. How do you reconcile these findings with this one?
Well, there's a little bit of evidence on that, actually. I mean, it's not very identified. Am I allowed to say identified on this podcast?
You are encouraged to say it, yes.
In the sense that when we measure the family history of exposure to La Violencia, actually, exposure to La Violencia is associated with greater pro-sociality, mm-hmm. exactly along the lines that you just alluded to. But that's very unidentified in the sense that there's a lot of selection in terms of whose family got targeted and whose family experienced violence. So we don't put much emphasis on that in the paper because of that. There's mm-hmm. a serious problem with selection there.
If we wanted to get away from this equilibrium in which antisocial norms hold, then what can we do about that? It sounds like a lot of people appreciate that they're not the best way to live. So just telling them that antisocial norms might be bad wouldn't work. What can we do?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I think the bottom line from this normative analysis is that what you really have to do is make it less attractive to appeal to these norms. And that's to do probably less with the informal institutions and more with the formal institutions. One of the reasons why norms like this flourish in a place like Colombia is that the state is extremely weak. It's very bad at implementing anything. My colleague, Steve Levitt in the economics department here, many years ago, he did some consulting in Colombia on the legal system and in the criminal justice system, which he found to be so appalling that one of the conclusions of the paper was that if you have to commit a murder, Colombia is the country to do it in. So the criminal justice system is so ineffectual. And the message there is a lot of people talk about these different types of interventions and perturbations you might be able to do to change people's social norms and things like that. But I don't think that's the policy conclusion from the paper. The policy conclusion from the paper is people's attitudes towards the norm is actually good. What you have to do is change people's incentives to invoke it. And I think that's more about the enforcement of the law and the enforcement of the written rules.
James, I hope there's going to be a lot more work about this in the future. I'm looking forward to it. But for now, thank you.
My pleasure.
The paper is discussion paper 19519 at CPR, if you want to look it up that way. It is called Antisocial Norms. Authors, Leopoldo Ferguson, Jose Alberto Guerra, and James Robinson.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. If you liked this episode, there are plenty more like it. So please tell your friends, your colleagues, and your followers, and spread the word. It's back to normal service later this week when we will bring you our scheduled episode, Young, Educated, and Unemployed.